Good morning, everybody, and welcome to ITE 1 Module 12 today. We're going to be talking about advanced operating systems. We have missed Module 11, which was on printers and scanners, and we will be missing another module as we go along. I'm not sure what the number is. Just bear with us, folks. Question going on here. Okay, that clarifies things a bit.
Okay, you don't have to do the 11 to 16 final exam. You have to do the exams, you have to do the 1 to 10 final, and you have to, like, the 1 to 10 final and the module exams. So that's what you have to do for the modules that you're going to do. So you'll do module 1 to 10 module exams, you'll do 12 and 14, 15, 16, I think, other modules we'll be doing. I looked it up from last year's. You can actually look at last year's audio and it'll show you which modules we're actually going to lecture on. And then you do the 1 to 10 final exam, but I don't think you have to do the 11 to 16 final. Although eager beavers can do the 11 to 16 and do as well as they can, and you probably should be able to answer all the questions in them. I've looked at it. It's not that impossible.
Okay. So now you should all feel very relieved. Hope you've had a good week, everyone, anyway. And let's get rocking and rolling. All the chat windows open so that we can start our quiz, first off. So, last time we were talking all about the communication methods and have good etiquette and good netiquette. So we're just going to do a quick quiz on that and then we'll get on with today's lecture. So question one, what is a good rule for a call centre technician to follow? Is it A, being proactive by avoiding speaking with upset or angry customers? B, considering each new customer call as a fresh start? C, following the first impression of the customer and use netiquette? Or D, focusing on how to repair the problem while the customer is speaking? Anyone says D, you're in trouble. And those that said B, you were correct. It's considering each new customer call as a fresh start. Well done. Okay. The next one that we have is one of those ones where we have two options. So I think I might just do it as a yes-no one, rather than asking for you to remember two. Okay, so which two actions are examples of good netiquette? Yes, no. Is this good netiquette? Avoid being beginning an email with a formal greeting when it is a reply. Yes or no?
Whoever said no is correct.
That's correct. Yep. Next one, yes or no? Help keep flame wars only for humanistic reasons. That's correct. Should you check grammar and spelling before you send an email? Have you noticed that we're getting a lot of abbreviations these days in email as well as like text messages?
Like that?
Yes, starting to creep into our emails as well.
I actually find it's interesting that a lot of the abbreviations I want to use in text messages, like TM for tomorrow and FR for friend, regular sighted people wouldn't understand. So I move that we start getting braille abbreviations in text mails, text messages, because they rock.
Yes. Okay, should you use mixed case in email instead of all uppercase or all lowercase? Yeah, that's correct.
That doesn't really make much difference for the average speech user unless you've got uppercase raised pitch turned on. But for sighted people, they don't like it at all. It makes their eyes wobble.
Just picturing all these wobbling eyes. Okay, question three. What is an SLA? Is it A, an itemized record detailing all levels of service performed on equipment covered by manufacturer warranty? Or is it B, a legal agreement between a customer and a service technician confirming specific services performed on equipment not covered by any warranty? Is it C, a legal agreement between a customer and the service vendor confirming a specific level of support? A, B or C? And for those that said C, you are correct. It is a legal agreement between the customer and the service vendor confirming a specific level of support. Well done. Okay, question 4. What is the primary responsibility of a level 1 technician? Is it A, to determine the cause of complex computer problems? B, is it to gather information from the customer? C, is it to use remote diagnostic software to connect to the customer computer? Or D, resolving computer problems that require opening up the computer? And for those that said B, you are correct. Okay, next question. Which task would be the responsibility of a level 2 technician? Now, do they resolve computer problems, this is A, that are limited to software errors? Do they, B, gather information from the customer? C, do they direct the customer to the appropriate computer vendor for help? Or D, do they resolve computer problems that require opening up the computer? That's an interesting one, isn't it?
It is.
Hmm. I think they should have an E. So it's resolving more complex problems on that one.
Which one do they want?
They want D, resolving computer problems that require opening up the computer.
I think that would be dependent on the help desk type itself. I mean, whilst on a lot of help desks, that
would
be true.
That's what I think, too.
But, for example, with an ISP help desk, you can have level 2 technicians that never even touch the user's home computers, like, physically.
That's right, yeah. Yeah, so, but the Cisco answer that you want is resolving computer problems that require opening up the computer. Okay. All right, we want two answers here, and they're short ones, so I will just give you A, B, C, D, E of these. Which two skills are most important for a successful computer technician to possess? Are they A, communication, B, computer repair knowledge, C, task maintenance, D, work escalation, or E, computer prioritization? And for those that said A and B, you are correct. That's fine. Okay, next question. We have, what is the proper way to conduct a telephone call to troubleshoot a computer problem?
Don't answer it.
Is it A, always gather information from the customer and escalate the problem? B, maintain professional behaviour at all times? C, ask personal questions to get better acquainted with the customer? Or D, explain each step to help the customer understand the troubleshooting process? And that's correct, yes. You're going to use professional behaviour at all times. An easy one, wasn't it? All right. Question 8. A user calls to report that a new computer is broken. The technician determines that the user is inexperienced and possesses a limited understanding of computer technology. How should the technician handle this call? I'm not saying. A, write up a brief trouble ticket and send the technician to the customer to resolve the computer problem. B, attempt to gather information using simple step-by-step process to determine the problem. C, explain technical terms to the customer to educate them so that they can describe the problem. Or D, direct the user to several websites to help them identify the problem. Yeah, you're all correct. You're going to gather the information and use a step-by-step process to find out what the problem is. Okay, last of the questions. A question. A customer calls asking for help with an error code that's displayed on a computer running Linux. The technician has limited experience with Linux. What should the technician do? Should they A, attempt to repair anyway, B, apologize and advise the customer that the technician hopes to receive training for Linux in the future, C, gather information about the problem and escalate the call to a level 2 technician, or D, ring Kerry? That's correct, yeah. You're going to gather information about the problem and escalate the call to a level 2 technician. Okay, excellent, well done.
It probably could. That's assuming I'm answering the phone. Otherwise, I'd get myself one of those answering machines that I can screen calls. So, yeah, that's kind of handy. It'd be good if you could do that on Skype, actually.
Well, you just see who's calling. Okay. It's talking caller ID, basically.
On Skype, I don't think you can you easily?
Yeah, you can, but you have to
go into the call menu, and it says answer so-and-so, and you know who's calling you.
In Australia, they don't send name information through with caller ID. You only get the number. So you just get 08 number I can't remember coming through, generally speaking.
Oh.
Although if you happen to be running a VoIP PABX and then you link it into the Google lookup and the Asteridex and all of the other lookup services, yes, you can actually do a reverse lookup of the number while the call's coming in. But I can probably wager that the average user doesn't have that sort of infrastructure in their house. So no, we don't get the name coming through the talking caller ID. Problem with my spoonerisms today. We don't actually get the name and number through, and very few of the talking caller ID units do phase 2 caller ID, which is the one that happens when you get call waiting. That's the one where it sort of goes beep beep and sends them information through, but they don't usually read that. There's only an expensive one from America that does that.
I bet it doesn't work here.
Who's that talking? Because they're very quiet.
Yeah, that's Scott, because he's got people in the office. He's got to be nice and quiet.
Oh, okay. No problem, Scott. No worries.
We call him Mr. Mumbles. I'm working for Gentleman's office. I've got some office full of people. Yeah, no, it's all good. When he doesn't have an office full of people, he'll be louder.
Oh, that's fine. Okay, so today's module we're talking about configuring and optimizing operating systems. So I know we've done some work on operating systems, but this module goes a little bit deeper into debt, perhaps. No, talking about more advanced aspects. Okay.
I was just going to point out this is actually quite a good module, and there's lots of good stuff in here that will help you optimize and configure your own computer, which will stop you from becoming deeper into debt, because the more of this you know, the less you're going to have to pay the technician.
Okay, let's get everybody to... we're talking about operating systems. Can you name some of the operating systems that are out there? Come on, one from everybody. Yep. Well done. Unix, all those. Yep, well done. Okay. Now, we're still going. Excellent. Okay, and basically now we're talking about the Windows versions of operating systems. How about giving me some different versions of Microsoft Windows that we have seen in the last few years? Yeah, 3.11, that was my first one. Yeah, that's great. And we get, obviously, the basic editions, the home editions. There's the premium editions. Who's running Vista at the moment? Anyone?
I am.
You are? Which version are you running, Grace?
I have one that's business, one I did run premium, or home premium, and I have an ultimate.
Okay.
I reckon it's just a ploy by Microsoft to make money. They've got 12 revisions
of... Oh, that's exactly what I did.
Yeah, they've got 12...
Yeah, they've got a few, haven't they?
12 revisions of Windows XP, and even more of Vista. So you can have, like, Home Starter, Home Basic, Home Premium, Business, Business
Ultimate.
Corporate, Mega, Ultra, Wibble. It's like, yeah, come on, guys. And the fact is, there's even a thing...
I believe they only have
six. Yeah, only six. Only six.
Available in all English-speaking markets. The sixth one is available in, like, the developing country.
Well, I couldn't actually quite catch what Scott said there, but Ian said it makes for a good Mac ad because there's only two versions of OS X, OS X Client and OS X Server, neither of which work very well. No, just kidding.
but at least there are only two.
Yeah, at least there are only two. I think the thing is that... And the thing with Vista, interestingly enough, there is an anytime upgrade option where you can actually give Microsoft your credit card details and they'll take you from one version to another. So there mustn't be that many files that need to be replaced to actually change the operating system version. And in fact, and not that I would condone this sort of behaviour, there are documents out there on the internet that will allow you to turn any sort of XP CD into any other sort of XP CD by hacking a few inf files. Now, not that anybody would ever do that, but it is possible.
I'm sure it's possible with Vista, too.
Yeah, I think it is. Is this better now?
Nah.
I'm still quiet.
You actually have to manually knock your mic level up in the Vistery thing.
Vistery thing. Nice techno speak there, Kerry.
Well, thing is about the nicest word I can think of.
Yeah, it's a pretty nice volume control.
Heard you a little bit better then.
Yeah, you're still very, very quiet. I don't know whether there's a microphone boost you've got to enable. Or are you trying to use the internal microphone on the laptop, or is this your magic headset, TM?
It's the headset. That's the weird part.
Make sure the flat side of the noise-cancelling microphone is facing your mouth, because if you tip it out by a few degrees, it'll just be shot.
No, this is a round mic.
Ah. There'll be holes on one side of it, and those holes have got to be facing where you're talking. I'm not sure where the holes would be. That's right, you're a musician. I'm sure you know how microphone works.
That's probably better.
Oh, do I? That's nice. I'm on a different computer, Jen. Okay, so the operating system, you're going to, as a technician, you're going to be asked a lot of times, which operating system do you advise?
Oh, me, yeah.
That's not very nice, Trevor.
Ah, Trevor. I've got a message for Trevor. If you get in touch with Ian at some point, he will go through your ITE2 exam with you, just so you know. I'm sure Jenny can tell Trevor that.
Okay, so that will be one of the most common question that you're going to be asked, what operating system do you advise? If you ask someone like Mr. Murray, he'll tell you that it'll be definitely a Mac. If you ask Kerry, he may advise you on some other operating system. But what you need to be able to do is to provide advice to your client about the type of operating system that's going to meet their actual needs. And if you think about it, the operating system actually provides you a bridge between your hardware and software applications. It stores your data in a file system, like a filing cabinet, manages your applications, and interprets the commands that you put into it. That's what we're going to talk about.
Yeah, but you actually need to give them reasons why one is better for them rather than the other. You don't want to go, I think you're stupid, so you should be running XP, because that doesn't make the user very happy, or you couldn't even find where the mouse is, so I suggest DOS. I mean, you can't be making statements like that. You've actually got to give them genuine reasons why they would run a particular operating system. I would suggest you don't run Windows Vista. Okay, we could be there all day with that one, but I suggest you don't run Windows Vista because Fugle-Woogle Accounting 123 isn't compatible with it.
Yeah.
Stuff like that, which Geraldine will cover in the notes in a minute. So you've actually got to give them legitimate reasons and not just sort of, you know, give them a half Nelson, install the operating system onto their computer and then let them go locking down the hard disk and the BIOS password so they can't ever change it. So you've actually got to give users, you know, justification and reasons for the operating system decision, not just force an operating system on them, as a lot of IT departments tend to do, interestingly enough.
They do. I was just going to say that. You can't just put your own thoughts, you know, your own preferences, because it might not be the best solution for the customer that you're dealing with. So you've got to be looking at what type of environment they're going to be running it in, what are their needs, what programs are they going to be running, making sure that everything's, you know, can run smoothly for them. The same goes when you're talking about network operating systems, where you've got a operating system that's got additional features so that you're working it in a networked environment. So could some of you give me some examples of some of the network operating systems that are around?
Anyone? Network operating systems?
XP, 2000 server.
Yeah, that's right. Yes. Any others?
There's server 2003 and 2008. Yep. OS X is a network.
Mac,
well,
yep.
Vista is a network operating system, the business versions.
Yeah, I've got.
Is it?
And, you know, you've got.
Well, it's got the. It's. Yeah, and there's some, and there's also the Enterprise, 2008 Enterprise or whatever. Actually, did people know there's actually a command line only version of Windows Server 2008, which I think is kind of cool? I don't think it's you SSH into it. I haven't actually played with it yet, but apparently it's pretty cool.
Wow,
sounds interesting.
Yeah, they got rid of the GUI because they finally realised that the GUI was putting too much processor load on the machine, so they got rid of the GUI, and then you do everything from the command line. Sorry, Scott.
Is the command line version just as expensive as the graphical version?
I couldn't say. I'm sure it would be relatively expensive, but I think they all are.
So if you're looking at advising someone on their own PC or on a network operating system, you're going to be, say, for example, looking at what their business is all about, what they actually requirements are, whether they're simple requirements or more advanced. When you think about server application, you know, servers, you need things like shared databases, centralized data storage, directory servers. You've got to think about print queues, access and security, and all that type of thing to determine what your client's going to be needing there. So your network operating system is going to give you extra features or extra functions. We talk about protocols there. So protocols basically are controlled by code that's on your network server. Things like file transfer, email, name resolution, IP addressing. Find that the operating systems today, one good thing about them is that they're pretty easy to install. You get all these step-by-step instructions that come up on when you're doing installation, which makes life nice and easy.
I should be waving my arm in the air going, like a monkey. Okay.
Pick me.
One of the things that I would like to point out to people who are planning to be computer technicians or who are looking at getting into the computer technician field, just because you can load on an operating system and get through the installation wizard does not make you an expert on that operating system, unless you define an expert as drip under pressure. Anyone can load on an operating system, whether or not you can actually run the operating system and administer the operating system afterwards is really the issue. So don't assume that just because somebody can install an operating system that they know all about it, because often the installation procedures are made exceedingly simple. But then once you've actually done the installation, the company who sells you the operating system then has you buy the proverbials for the support and stuff that goes along with the operating system, as anybody will have found out if they've actually had to call Microsoft, which is never a pleasant experience.
Not anyone can install an operating system.
You're a bit quiet, actually, Grace, at the moment.
Better?
Yep.
Yes. Mm. Okay, so talking about installing operating systems, there's a couple of ways that we can actually do that. When you get your wizard coming up, you're going to have a couple of options. Anyone know what those options are that you might get?
Is this for installing Windows?
Hmm.
Yeah, this is in the test, guys. Anybody know what options come up in the wizard as far as installation types?
Upgrade and clean install.
No, that they the
won't actually show that. No.
No. That's not the one we want. They're the two different installation types. You're correct. But we actually want the Yeah. I've got one of them coming up there. Yep.
Yeah, default is one. Yeah.
Actually, I think it's called.
I think
typical.
Somebody else said. Yes.
No, there isn't a default. There's typical and custom. Typical, custom,
typical
compact.
And custom. It comes up in the notes here as default, but it is typical, it says. Yeah. So, yeah, typical is the what one of the options is, and the other is custom. Okay. Anyone tell me the difference between them?
Picks the most
typical only asks no questions, and or very few questions, and the custom asks you about everything.
Yes, yeah.
And then compact doesn't install all the help files, which of course you find out the hard way when you press F1 the first time, because it's meant to be used on laptops and stuff.
Okay, so obviously if you're picking typical as your selection, it's just going to move along and install things for you. You're not going to have to think about it too much.
Now, which one should you be picking? As a person in this class, which one should you be picking? Well done. We'll pass you. If you, as a network administrator, go through and do a typical install, you'd better know exactly what the defaults for typical are, because you might get some nasty surprises. So just be aware of that. You probably do want to be going custom. Well, actually, probably more specifically, you want to go through with Nlight and Vlight and actually customize up the CD image yourself and then actually run the installable CD image. But if you're not doing that, then you probably want custom, because you may have to set up and check through the screens of parameters unless you've done the unattended installs, which we talked about on last week's Thursday chat.
Okay, let's see who... Perhaps not everyone was there. Do you want to go through that with them, Kerry?
No, I'll let them...
There is some in the notes, that's all.
Yeah. Mm. Well, I think what we'll do is we'll let them refer to last week's Thursday chat, because we talk about Nlight and Vlight, and there's some resource kit tools that you can pull from Microsoft that will give you the necessary bits to build your unattended installations. And there's also a podcast on Blind Cool Tech, which takes you through the unattended installs of Windows XP. And just double checking, did any of the people that we were talking to last week, have you found the notes?
Oh, yes, good point.
or does everybody on this channel know where all the notes are for ITE1? Everybody's cool with it? No, that's fine. We'll just excuse us while we're a little bit paranoid for a couple of weeks. Geraldine's
dog
is
snoring very badly. Oh, that might have been Jenny I could hear. Okay.
Oh, good. You did find them?
Excellent. Okay. Anyone like to have a go at telling us what an image-based installation is?
It's a installation that you might run over a network or on a CD that's just an image of the operating system, and it does it from there.
That's pretty good.
That's unattended.
Yeah. Unattended is where you've got all the settings set. Usually an image installation is a prototypical install that is loaded onto a workstation, onto multiple workstations. For example, if you buy an Asus EEPC or an MSI Wind, they actually do an image-based install that's been customized and mucked around for the particular machine, and you just load that image onto the machine. So that's your image-based installation. Microsoft would have you do it with SysPrep, although most of us use Ghost, depending on who you talk to, or Image for Windows. Actually, Image for Windows is a really good bit of kit, and it's actually highly accessible. And in fact, there's even a Linux version of it, And the only reason I'm promoting this is because I'm a happy customer. There's an image version that you can boot up off a CD or a thumbstick, and then you can SSH into the machine and use an NCURSOR or text-based interface to actually image off your partitions, back off your removable drives, back onto your main drives. So, yeah, terabyte unlimited sell image for Windows, and it's a good bit of kit, and it's not very expensive, so it's worth a look.
Just going to ask you what the price was.
I think it's about $60 or $70, and you get the one for DOS, the one for Linux, and the one for Windows.
Okay.
And it works with Vista. Had to put that in.
Oh, we have to have that.
Okay, what, anyone want to have a try at telling me what a remote installation is then?
Has anybody pre-read the notes just out of morbid curiosity?
I can tell you what a remote installation is.
Oh, I realise you're giving everybody else a chance, but I'm just wondering whether anybody apart from you has pre-read the notes.
Don't all say yes at once.
Okay, let's, yeah.
Let's assume, no. Okay. All right, Grace, do you want to have a try at explaining that?
That's usually run over a network to a bunch of different computers. You don't actually use a physical CD. You just run it over the network, and there it goes.
Yes.
We have someone answers. Yes, yeah, that's correct. Yes, you're both correct.
And you can get a free version. No, that's okay. You can either use the Microsoft RIS, which is Remote Installation Kit, which apparently is a service even, which costs money and is very difficult to set up. Or you can have a look on unattended.sourceforge.net for a free-to-use but quite tricky-to-set-up remote installation setup for Windows. Although, once you've done it, it's actually quite worth it, but it will take you about 2 or 3 hours to actually set up all the servers and stuff properly. That's if you're rolling out lots of remote installations of various operating systems.
Okay, so they're the different types of ways you can install. So once you've got your operating system there, you want to be optimizing it, managing all your files and directories. And the files and directories are just the locations where you're storing or organizing the data that you have on your computer. The file system that you're using by the operating system determines things like the partition size, you know, cluster size, and the security features that are installed. Okay, when you're talking about partitioning, formatting disks in Windows, there is a disk management utility. And what that does is it displays information about and performs services, things like, and you want to do things like forming a disk. There are a number of different partitions or several of them on your hard drive. Anyone want to tell me some of the partitions that are on there?
Well, we can have the C partition where all our programs will probably be. We could make a data partition, D for data. You could have, like, all sorts of partitions.
I know what you're saying, but if we talk about the partitions, we're referring to them like as the primary partition, your extended partitions.
This is my good ranty time.
And your logical drives.
Which is where I get to talk about all these different partition types for about 2 minutes, because it's not really covered very well. Okay. Okay, the DOS partition table has slots. The DOS primary partition table, or the master boot record, in fact, which is the first sector on a hard disk, track 0, side 0, sector 1, has 446 bytes of master boot record code. No, this is not in the test. It has space for 4 primary partitions, and it has a 2-byte signature, which is usually set to 55AA or AA55, which says that the partition is bootable. Hard disk is bootable, I should say. The 4 primary partitions can either be partitions that contain an operating system, or they can be a partition entry that contains what we call an extended partition. An extended partition is actually a pointer to a sector that contains a secondary partition table. The first entry points at the previous petition table. The second entry and third entry contain two logical drives or logical petitions, and the fourth entry in that secondary petition table points to the next extended petition table. This is so that you can have more than four primary petitions. If we didn't have extended petitions, you can only have four primaries. You can have you can only have one extended petition, and you can have up to three primaries. Okay, clear as mud. Anybody got any questions? No, seriously, a lot of that is not in the notes, but it's important to understand how the petitions are laid out. For example, only primary petitions are generally considered bootable. You cannot boot an operating system from an extended petition without a special bootloader. Yes, I know Grub and Lilo can do it, but that's but only if they're installed in the master boot record. So, for example, you cannot install an operating system into an extended petition or a logical drive on an extended petition and have it boot up. So be aware of that.
Can anyone tell me how you would actually get into the disk management utility? Or one way you could do it?
Under which operating system? Windows?
Yes, under Windows, sorry.
It's under administrative tools in the control panel.
No. The BIOS will only tell you what size the drives are, and there are actually there is a low-level format option in the BIOS which you probably shouldn't be using anymore, but historically it's still there. The BIOS usually tells you what drives you've got and which drives you can boot from and which boot priorities you're setting up.
Yes, so through, as you said, Grace, through the start menu, control panel that way, administrative tools. I think it's sent to computer management and
system to down the bottom.
There. Yeah, it's another system there, isn't it?
Yeah. Or you can go, start run disk mgmt.msc,
which is a nice quick way to do it. Okay, so been talking about the partitioning. So partitions are formatted with a file system, and the for example, in Windows XP, those two file systems are FAT32 and NTFS. The NTFS has a more security features, and is, you know, the one that we usually see now in the later operating systems. Okay, just scrolling down to see what we need to put here. All right. Okay. Is everyone familiar with the differences between FAT32 and NTFS?
Yeah. Can anybody give us a difference between FAT32 and NTFS?
NTFS has security.
Yes. More specific?
You can compress and uncompress, and you can sort of encrypt files.
Yeah, no, that's correct. What I was after was NTFS has file system level security. FAT32 does has share level security, which is at the network layer. So, yeah, NTFS has file level security. Yep. Can anybody give me another difference between NTFS and FAT32, perhaps? Anyone else? Alex is saying that one of them has size limitation, and that would be that you cannot store a file bigger than 2 gigabytes in size on a FAT32 file system, which means if you do the disk copy of a DVD in Nero and you're running FAT32, it will fail, interestingly enough, because you can't get 4.7 gig onto one file.
Any questions up to that point?
Oh.
Yes, we have one.
There is FAT32 does support smaller cluster sizes now. FAT16 didn't. The maximum size of a FAT16 petition was 2 gigabytes, but you can actually override the cluster size on FAT32 if you know what you're doing. So that's not so bad. I was actually just going to make a comment, actually, that interestingly enough, which file system should you be running on a netbook that uses solid-state storage?
FAT32, isn't it?
That's correct, because the journal will thrash the flash disk. I don't really think in practice it makes much difference, but that if you are running if you are running a file system on a solid-state storage device that has a limited number of write cycles, they tend to recommend that you run a FAT file system. Otherwise, you can actually thrash the file system with the journal updates. However, it is possible to turn the journal off on an NTFS disk. And there's this FSUtil thing that lets you do that. And a journal is a device, is a thing that lets you you commit updates to the journal, and then the journal then commits updates to the file system. And if your machine crashes, you can bring it up and replay as many of the transactions from the journal. However, generally speaking, only metadata is journaled, so it will ensure file system consistency, but it doesn't necessarily protect the data, which is a very important point to realise.
Okay. All right, I think that's a good explanation. All right, so the when you're optimising your operating system, there are a number of tools that you can utilise within Windows. Some of the tools, things like check for errors on the disks, you can look for file structure errors and defragmentation. Everybody using Windows running their defrag on a regular basis?
Oh yeah.
That's good. How often is everyone running it, just out of interest sake?
Like once every 3 months or so.
Oh, okay. I did mine about every 2 weeks. But
yeah,
I think
if you're...
That's how much you're doing, doesn't it?
If you're copying lots of video files and stuff around, you probably want to be running it fairly regularly. If you're a Windows user, I would strongly recommend the utility JKDefrag, as in Juliet Kilo Defrag. It actually puts all of your movies and MP3 files and stuff out to the end of the disk and puts all of the small files back towards the beginning of the disk. And I've actually noticed a very highly increased performance on machines once I've run JK Defrag on them. It's a lot smarter than the Windows defragmentation utility.
Probably works a lot better than Vista's defrag utility too.
Oh, the Vista one's a joke, if you ask me.
That's a free utility too, isn't it, Kerry?
Yeah, it is. JK Defrag's free,
which is nice. There are a number of ones, utilities that you can purchase as well. We're not going to recommend one, but I'm sure people have got utilities that they've paid for and really like. But yeah, for a nice, very good program, JK Defrag is excellent. Okay, the virtual memory allows your CPU to look at the or address the more memory than is installed in the computer. So it's done so that every application can address or look at the same amount of memory. It's a swap or page file, and it's being constantly read so as it's in and out of RAM. So really, you should be letting Windows manage the size of your swap files. The only thing that you may be wanting to look at is changing the location of the swap files, and to do that you need to be a member of the have administrator rights. To access your virtual memory settings, say for example in XP, you can go through your control panel and then it's into System, I think, Advanced, and then your performance options for memory. So we talked about disk defragmenting. Does anyone want to try and explain what actually defragmenting means or what it actually does? Why you would be doing it?
Is anyone apart from Grace awake? I know Scott's on the phone.
It does. It helps you to...
Now maintain a professional
That's
manner
okay,
at all
Scott.
Times.
Right.
Of course he will, yes. Okay, so it helps you to optimise your files on your hard drive. Files that are accessed or you stored on your hard drive, they keep changing from being contiguous files on the disk to being scattered across the disk.
Contiguous.
And what happens is it
just correcting that one.
What did I say?
You said contiguous. Yeah, contiguous.
Oh, okay.
That's all right.
I stand corrected. Okay, and what happens is it causes your operating system to slow down. If you're finding that your operating system is slowing down, you haven't defragged for a while, it's a good idea to do.
Can anybody tell me why non-contiguous files would slow down your operating system on mechanical-style hard disks?
Because they have to find all the little bits of it, and it takes it longer to find it.
That is correct. You have increased head movement, therefore you have more seek latency. I mean, the average seek latency on a hard drive is a minimum of 2 milliseconds. Your average seek, which is the time taken to seek across a third of the disk surfaces, is usually around 8 to 9 milliseconds, and a full stroke seek is from one end of the disk to the other, which is about 12-13 milliseconds on most hard disks. So the more seeks you need to do, the more difficult it is to find the data, the longer it takes for the hard drive to pick up all the different pieces. However, because flash media, or SSD, or solid-state disks, have limited write cycles, it is generally not advisable to defrag flash disks very often at all. Sorry, back to you, Jolene.
Yes, okay. Okay, so another thing you should probably be doing to optimize your computer too is to looking at your temporary files. Usually, every program that we use uses temporary files, and they're usually automatically deleted, but some of them actually need to be deleted manually because they're actually taking up hard disk or space on your computer. So probably a good idea to have a check on them.
Who's played with CCleaner? Anyone played with CCleaner?
Yep. Oh, yeah. It saved me from very bad installs before.
Yeah, CCleaner is pretty good. Just be careful with CCleaner, though. The default is to wipe out all your cookies. And if you forgot your password on Facebook, you don't want it to do that. So make sure you check the options before you run it. There are two versions of CCleaner. One is the regular version, and the other one is the light version. And the light version doesn't have the Yahoo toolbar in it. So when you're installing the regular version of CCleaner, make sure you uncheck the install Yahoo toolbar, or you will end up with it in your browser.
That can be said with a lot of programs too. You go through, and if you're just going next, 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 suddenly you've got Yahoo toolbar or Google toolbar and some other toolbar that you don't want.
Absolutely. And I call those people install rabbits that basically just, you know, they go next, 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 next,
next,
and then
next.
They got flattened by something. So you got to watch out for that. So do pay attention to the install screens. Don't assume that just because it's got a next button that it's going to do what you want it to. So do actually look at the dialog boxes and make sure that you can actually see that... Good morning, Elise. Make sure that you can see that things are... all good. CCleaner is good, and if you actually register it, which I think is about $15 or $20 US, €10 I think it is, he'll actually send you emails of newer versions before everybody else gets to look at them. So it's kind of worth doing. And in fact, if there is cheap shareware that you actually use, I would strongly recommend that you support these people who are actually writing this cheap shareware for you, because it is actually very good, and they're trying to put food on the table and you know, feed their kids and whatever else. And maybe $10, $15, $20 here there isn't going to hurt your bank book too much. But there's no point pirating everything when things are actually affordable. So I'd really suggest that people, you know, buy the cheap shareware. There is also a free program from the same people, Piriform Software, who make CCleaner, called Defragler. And it's actually a specific defragmentation file where you can go just defragment the files in this folder or just defragment the files in that folder. And it's another very good free defragmentation utility. If you are looking for lots of good free software, and I didn't even know I was going to say this, so we hadn't actually planned this, you can go and have a look on www.thefreecountry.com. and there's all sorts of free stuff out there. So that's if you really can't afford, you know, shareware, or you don't have the money to do shareware, or you don't have a PayPal account, or for whatever reason. But if you do have the money and you can, and you find that you're using a program every day of the week and stuff, and it is a piece of shareware, or even a piece of open source that requires donations, think about giving the people a few dollars. A bit like the Cisco Academy. Of course, we'd prefer you donate to us first and them second, but, you know.
Yeah, I was just going to say that.
But, yeah, that donation link on that webpage is for everyone. But, yeah, so basically, if you can, if you do donate to these software courses and stuff, that makes them happy. And interestingly enough, I will be making a donation to Lodestone very soon, and I'll be making a donation to 7-Zip, so I'm practicing what I preach. 7-Zip doesn't actually require you to donate, but I'm sure the bloke would be very happy if he got a couple of dollars.
And it's an excellent program.
Yeah, woof woof.
Okay, we were talking about the temporary files. Anyone tell me how you're going to locate where they are? There's a few different ways.
Well, you can go into the program area and see if there's a place that stores its temporary files.
Yep. You can actually go through the command line as well. C:\temp will do it. C:\tmp. There's a few other commands. I think Windows \temp as well.
Yeah, there's C. Yeah.
C Sorry. Colon Windows tmp as well. Yeah.
What were you saying, Elise?
Hello, Elise, by the way.
Hello, Geraldine, how are you? I have a feeling... C:\temp no longer...
I got a feeling...
She's got a
feeling... deep inside, oh yeah.
Oh, please.
Doesn't take much to settle, Geraldine, does it?
I haven't sung for ages, but Elise was on.
I think I'd better come in and drop in for the next few Fridays to get Geraldine happening. You're probably missing her singing, aren't you, Terry?
Yes.
Come on along, get happy.
C:\temp tends to be a DOS convention. However, if you do set the TMP and temp environment variables, Windows will actually stick stuff in ctemp and ctmp.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Now the services. So we were just playing around with these for a little while ago, weren't we, Kerry?
We were. We stopped Geraldine's Security Centre service.
Kept on telling me that I didn't have a firewall active, and it was.
No,
so.
Yes, that's a good old trick. Switch off the Security Centre and keep your sanity.
Yeah, exactly.
That's what I do.
Yeah, that's better, Grace. We can hear you now. Skype munched her volume control. If you want your microphone hammered into the ground, stamped on, and then sat on by 6 footy players, let Skype automatically adjust your audio settings. Just a warning, if you don't want your microphone levels smashed and you want to be audible on Ventrilo, go and uncheck the boxes that say automatically muck with my sound level settings. Just make sure you've got the right recording sources selected, though, when you make a Skype call, or people won't hear you. That's the only downside.
Okay, so yes, services, very handy. They're a type of application that actually runs in the background, and it sits there waiting for requests. Come on, get my services. I can't do ads like Kerry. So, you've got to set up your services that you want started. There's a number of settings that you can use to control the services. You can have them on automatic or manual, or you can actually disable them or stop them, which is what I did with that security setting. All right, what about things like selecting updates from your... How do you have your settings for receiving updates? Do you have them to automatic, or do you have them to notify me first before downloading? Things like that. How's everybody having
it
set up?
Download for me.
You have it on automatic, do you?
No, she has it
download
for me.
I have it download it for me, and then I'll look at it.
Oh, okay.
Install them.
Yeah, that's the...
But That's because, and this is just a warning for people, that's because Grace is on I can use as much bandwidth as I want and I can watch my television shows across the internet if I want. Whereas if you're on a bandwidth cap, if you have it automatically pulling the downloads down, you could pull down 100, 200 megs of updates without realising it. And if you're on a 300 meg quota and they charge you at 35 cents a meg, that could be rather a costly mistake if you've got a couple of machines.
Exactly what happened to my friend in Ballarat. Terry, exactly that scenario when she got her Triple E PC.
Yeah, and and especially if you pull down Service Pack 3 or whatever for Windows XP, that'll be a couple of hundred megs you'll never see again.
It ripped down, I think it ripped down most of Service Pack 3. I think it ripped down IE7, I can't remember, but I said, look, when you come over here next week, bring it over here, put it on my connection, and you can get down what you want.
Yeah, and I'd strongly recommend advising against automatic, because what actually happened was there was an update that came out recently, 960-something-something-something, kilobits for Windows XP. It smashed most programs that use the Visual Basic runtime, including JAWS. They've since fixed that, funnily enough. There's actually an active roll-up for kilobits that actually fixes that now. And if you install the latest version of the active roll-up for kilobits, you're all good. But if you install the earlier one, you are down for the count. So automatic at your peril, people.
I at least take a look before I install things, so at least if I know when something goes wrong, I know what I did and what might be the problem.
There is also one other thing to be aware of, and it actually does tell you this on the screen, but as I said, nobody reads these days. It is possible that if you are set to notify me but don't automatically download, that Windows will automatically update parts of Windows Update automatically without asking you, the actual Windows Update framework, and that may, in future, include portions of Windows Genuine Advantage. And believe me, when Windows Genuine Advantage goes bad, which it does every couple of months, you can actually get legitimate users being told that they've got illegitimate copies of Windows, which is not a lot of fun at all.
So you've been warned. Okay. And that is something that can happen, and people get into real strife financially with if they got their automatic settings and it's just downloading large amounts of data. Okay, some of the applications that we typically use on most computers, things like our web browser and email, I don't know what everybody's preference is here, but actually at the moment I'm running Internet Explorer 8, which I'm finding rather interesting. Anyone else running that at the moment? I know Kerry is.
I really like it.
It's great, isn't it?
I was offered it the other day. Is it any better than 7? I said no, because
faster.
I
thought
it is.
It's
a lot faster.
Yes, yep. You large print people will be bouncing around going, oh, look at my big images render. Woohoo! So, yeah, you want it. It's fast.
Oh, I don't know about that.
It's good.
So, I noticed Mozilla Firefox is quite fast. So
faster than Firefox.
It might actually. Oh, that's pretty good. Yeah, it could be very good. So,
yeah, they've cleaned up their act.
How does JAWS 10
fine.
Do it?
Fine.
Oh, I'll get it down and put it on.
Yeah, people have been running it for months. It's fine.
Well, it's going over 6.
I only put it on a week ago, Elise, but it's good.
Yeah, that's all right. No, because I was going to put a thing into Cavi Discuss and say, has anyone tried 8? And if so, what's the feedback?
Sign up for Windows
Secrets. Yeah, I couldn't
believe
it when I heard there was problems with JAWS. I was just like, what? That's ridiculous, because I wasn't having any trouble.
No, I'm not having any problems.
There are a couple of, especially on the highly active Web 2.0 sites, where JAWS goes a bit funny. For example, if you've got auto forms mode on and you drop onto Facebook and down arrow into a form field, it'll often pop you into auto forms mode and then you can't cursor out again.
It'd probably do that in 7 too, though.
Are we keeping you up, Grace?
Poor Grace.
No.
It's probably late in Colorado. What's the time in Colorado? 8 o'clock?
Yes, I'm sure it is.
I'm in Wisconsin, actually. It's like almost 9:30, 10. Let me.
Okay.
9:15.
Early bedtime.
Well, I'm running 7 on this computer and it's fine. So, will it go on over the top of 6 or do you need 7?
Yes, it will.
All right, I'll put it on later.
Yeah. Look, take a restore point. Or obviously you've got six cats of the drive, whatever you want to do, you know, six cats of the drive, or a restore point, which will be fine, and drop it on. I don't think you're going to have any problems. You probably want to turn off all the accelerators and the filters and stuff as it goes on, although you might actually appreciate those. But it's certainly worth upgrading. And if it really causes you a problem, there's actually a compatibility button you can click on the toolbar that makes it behave like Internet Explorer 7 again. So they actually do have compatibility settings in case the way they render HTML code and stuff breaks some website that you're happy with. RSS support is greatly improved. And in fact, I know people who are using it specifically for RSS. Although, personally, I use NewsGator Mobile, and it is actually the leanest, meanest, nicest RSS solution I have ever seen in my life, and it even beats all the browsers.
That's exactly NewsGator. Why I came and stuck my head in the door today. I thought, well, you know, it's all very well doing IT and coming back, but you just never know when you pick up these snippets of information that are helpful, so thank you.
There's always the recordings on the QCAD website, but of course there is the interactive aspect
as well. But we prefer to have you with us, of course, Elise.
I think you did.
Absolutely.
Yes, I'm with you. You can actually pass IT 1, so there you go.
Yeah. NewsGator, GATOR.com. I think the consumer level services are free. They were made free a couple of months ago. And I know people love the word free. And so people might want to go and have a look at newsgator.com. It's a very good and reliable RSS aggregator. If you have other aggregators that you use, feel free to stick with them. There is an aggregator in Firefox. There is one in IE8. If you're running Linux, there's RSS Dropper, which will drop RSS feeds into a mailer so that you can pull them out with a mail client. If you're running, there's also Snow News, S-N-O-W News. So Snow News is good news. whatever aggregator you want to use.
Okay, so yeah, the Internet Explorer 8, I think is pretty unanimous from those using it that we're enjoying it. So that's good. Okay, you can also customise your web browser settings. I know that many of you are probably doing this, so who'd like to give us some of the things you've got customised on your web browser? And how you do it.
I actually turn my images off. There are actually reasons why some people can't turn images off, obviously. But I browse with images off because that saves me 80% of my web bandwidth. Ah, yes, WebVism is good to have. Navigation sounds is a good one. AdBlock Plus is another good one for Firefox. They're the three that I recommend to people. WebVism you need an invite code for, but it'll actually solve captures for you on websites. So you hit Control F5. I think it's Control F5 or Control F6. I can't remember which one.
It's Alt Control 6.
The version I've got works just with Control F5, interestingly enough. Maybe I've got an old version.
Well, maybe I don't have a new version.
Yeah, I think they've updated it, so it's just Control F5. Anyway, if you're not sure, you can go into the WebVism menu and select Help, and it will tell you what the current key bindings are, and you can actually change them to be whatever you want. But, basically, once you've got WebVism installed and you get one of those captures, you hit whatever the keystroke happens to be. We'll pretend that it's Control F5 at the moment. No, it's Control 5, I should say. And it'll go, bink! The capture has been sent to WebVism for analysis. You will be notified when the answer is ready. And then about 30 to 40 seconds later, it will actually put the result of the capture on the clipboard so you can paste it into the edit field. So certainly worth doing. There is a capture limit of one per minute, and I think there's a certain limit on how many you can submit per hour, but if you're submitting that many captures, I wonder what you're doing. But yes, it solves most of them. It does the Facebook one, it does the Twitter one, it does the Google Mail ones, so an incredible number of captures actually get solved by it.
One day I was moving all sorts of stuff over from different email accounts, and I had to do I don't even know how many captures in 1 hour. So if I didn't reach the limit, nobody else will, because I was going crazy.
Okay, so talking about the customizable aspects, if you say, for example, you...
Okay, yeah, so you're modifying the homepage in Internet Explorer settings, and you've got open each page in a new tab. Careful with that one, because you will actually take your machine down sideways if you go to the wrong site and some JavaScript fires open 10 windows. But that is certainly a preference you can set. You can also have your tab bar go from here to Kalgoorlie, so just be aware of that as well. But that is personal preference. Also, in Internet Explorer 7 and 8, a lot of people don't realise, and it says so in the dialog box, but as previously discussed, people don't read. If you want multiple tabs to open when you open the browser, you put each home page on a new line, and it will actually open a number of tabs when you first launch Internet Explorer. So, for example, our students could have www.qcat.org opening in one tab, and cisco.netacad.net opening in another tab, just as an example.
Doesn't that take forever to load up your Internet Explorer window every time you launch it then, though?
No, it spins each tab off in a separate thread. They've thought of you.
Ah, perfect.
Yeah, they actually open up each tab in a different thread. So the threads actually run concurrently, and it doesn't block on one particular tab. Because you're right, that would be stupid. So yeah, what it does is it actually fires off simultaneous threads, and then it fires up all the processes, all the different tabs that you're opening. It's possible that the tab you actually want to read may not have loaded yet, but that all depends on the response of the remote web servers and stuff. So, for example, if you've got your Live Journal Friends page and Live Journal's being slow, it might actually take time for one of those particular tabs to come down. But while it's coming down, you could be reading your RSS feeds in another tab.
Any other questions there before we move on? Okay, so you can customise your web browser so that it's optimised for your usage. In Internet Explorer, for example, a quick way to do it is just to go to your Tools menu and then Internet Options after you've gone there. Kerry talked a little bit earlier about cookies. Not the nice little ones that you eat.
Cookies.
Who used to say that?
Cookie Chris. Monster.
Oh, yeah, I know that. I was thinking of students. That was Chris, wasn't it?
It was.
Yeah. So cookies are just little bits of information that's transmitted between a web browser and a web server. And they've got the purpose of tracking the user information and to customise the page that's actually delivered to the user. The end user there. Now, a lot of people have this impression that all cookies are bad.
Okie dokie. We're talking about cookies. And cookies are bits of information that are stored on your machine by a website. And they are information that is handed to you by the web server at the remote end. And then when you submit an HTTP request, you actually send along all of the stored cookies that you have with it that are valid for that domain. And not all cookies are bad. Some cookies are actually good. And in fact, there's a little note on the bottom of all the Cisco pages that says you must have JavaScript and cookies enabled, otherwise Cisco will work very badly for you. There are tracking cookies, however, that will actually track things that you're doing, and that in itself can be a problem, especially with ad sites and stuff. And in fact, I'm sure Grace probably empties out her cookie jar fairly regularly, because I'm sure it fills up with all sorts of fun stuff. Okay, now the next thing we're talking about is temporary internet files. And temporary internet files are the files that your browser stores to cache various pages and stuff you've loaded to increase... you'll just have to make do with what we've got, guys. We've got the internet connectivity we've got, and there's nothing we can do about it. I'm sorry. If I'm breaking up,
yeah,
you can get the recording. Well, it's either that, guys, or call off the entire lecture. I'm just trying to find the ping times, but it's not showing up on my machine at the moment. How much have we got left? We'll finish the lecture next week, guys. Nothing we can do about it until internet's restored, and even if internet's restored, we can't guarantee stability. All right, guys. Yeah, okay. All right. Bye.